Bring your hands up above your head. I'm going to call the Kriya, unplugging your nervous system from the global economy.
The Serpentine Podcast. On work.
This is the Serpentine Podcast on work. In this series, we ask what is work and how should we be valuing our labor? I'm Victoria Sin. I'm back again with Lucia Pietro-Justi for episode 2.
Hi, Victoria.
Hello. Lucia, have you ever heard of Jack the Baboon or Tibbs the Cat?
No, do tell.
Jack the Baboon worked as a railroad signalman in South Africa in the 1870s for 9 years. He was paid 20 cents a day and half a bottle of beer a week.
Oh, wow.
And Tibbs the Cat was paid 2 shillings a week to be the ratter at the post office in the UK for 14 years. And in 1952, there was public outrage that the cats had not had a pay rise since 1873. And the next year, the matter was taken into the House of Commons.
Wow, I really wish I was there for that.
Right?
I mean, I guess we could also just think critically a little bit about this, because these two examples tell us that we should be valuing, or we may have valued, the labor of non-human animals. But it also says that that labor should fit within a kind of capitalistic value giving.
Yeah, it's like anthropomorphizing animals to a way. It's like, I mean, I don't think that like the cat really cared if it had had a pay rise.
Maybe the fact of thinking that labor or work is everything that is attached to a kind of a value or a money or a payment blinds us to a whole host of invisible kinds of work and labor that have nothing to do with value payment.
Yeah, of course.
Or time. Even.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the cat would have done it whether or not it was being paid to do it. Because, I mean, I don't know if you've ever tried to convince or train a cat to do anything, but it's like basically impossible.
That's right. I have one. And I, yes, years. So obviously all of this connects really deeply with what we're about to hear. Do you want to tell us why?
So every episode we choose a new lens through which to define and understand work. Today, we're looking at work in a post-human interspecies landscape. This episode, we've partnered up with Het Nieuwe Instituut, who've commissioned the brilliant Dutch Pavilion at the Venice Architecture Biennale 2018, curated by Rotterdam-based architect and researcher Marina Otero, who we've been working with on this episode. Lucia, you've been over to the Venice Architecture Biennale. What's the Dutch Pavilion like?
So this is one of my favorite pavilions ever, I think. And part of the reason why I loved it is that it's also a research network and a kind of long-term project. So it kind of exceeds the space itself where it happened. It's going to go on, I hope, forever. But the experience of being in the space was that of a very bright orange locker room.
Yeah, I saw photos.
Yeah, and it was very vivid and very intense when you're there. And as you open the lockers, they actually lead you into different projects and different works that address notions around work, embodiment, materiality, labor, and also cyborgs, post-human questions around enslaved bodies. And so it was a very multi-form and multidisciplinary and multi-vocal pavilion.
It sounds almost like kind of like an archive.
It was, yes, something like a living archive of different thoughts and politically also very vibrant thoughts, I thought, around these ideas.
So Marina invited guests into the studio today for a discussion on labor in a post-human interspecies landscape.
I'm Marina Otero, Director of Research at Het Nieuwe Instituut in Rotterdam and Curator of Work, Body, Leisure, the Dutch Pavilion at the 16th Venice International Architecture Biennial in 2018. The Work, Body, Leisure exhibition was formed out of a collective research project that brought together architects, designers, knowledge institutions, and also the private sector to explore the future of labor and also the impact of emerging technologies of automation. Today, I'm continuing this conversation with three speakers whose work relates to our research at the new institute.
I'm Patricia McCormack. I'm Professor of Continental Philosophy at Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge, and I'm the author of Posthuman Ethics and The Animal Catalyst, and I work with posthuman theory toward an ecological and ecosophical territory that liberates posthumanism from its techno-fetishism.
My name is Amal Haq. I'm an independent curator, researcher, and I've been working currently on this project called Technologies of Certain Bodies. It's a project that explores and moves actually on the intersection of technology, bodies, specifically the enslaved, the ethnographic, and the cyborg body.
Hi, I'm Susan Shupley. I'm an artist researcher based at Goldsmiths, where I'm the director of the Center for Research Architecture. Collectively, our work has been organized around investigating human rights violations. And more recently, during the past year, we ran a project with our master's students called Logistical Nightmares. And that was an attempt to turn our analysis towards questions of automation, of logistics, of infrastructure in relationship to the kinds of questions and discussions that we're going to have here today.
Susan, you work in cases of human rights violations. So how do you think automation is changing the landscape of labor rights?
There are still vast swaths of laboring bodies in parts of the developing world where it's simply cheaper not to automate, but to pay people incredibly low kind of wages, etc. So automation doesn't mean the sort of like removal of the body from certain kind of labor practices. As far as I'm concerned, it would be about the ways in which labor once again gets redistributed. And of course, what we also see with automation, we see the invention of new forms of labor. So a kind of managerial class, certainly, but also the oversight of a lot of automated systems requires a different set of labor practices. For example, obviously, call center workers, that's a kind of automation, right? That's a consequence of automation, so a kind of vast rise in that type of labor.
If this type of system serves to perpetuate exploitation, should we consider like discussion around the possibility of having wages, for instance, for robots or for other beings? So what do you think about that possibility to recognize the work of different bodies through maybe wages or any other form, if we talk about some material compensation of labor?
First of all, when we think about animals, animals within agribusiness have a legal status of property. That which is property cannot accrue wages under the law. Now, we would need a different legal infrastructure, and we see that emerging in some other contexts like Bolivia, Ecuador, which have a Pachamama constitution around the rights of nature, for example. But for the moment, in the United Kingdom, animals are property, and therefore there is no kind of legal mechanism whereby they could actually be acknowledged as sort of wage laborers. Even, for example, at Goldsmiths, we have a therapy dog that in some way you could say is performing a kind of affective labor, but nonetheless, even that kind of labor in relationship to sentient life, there's a fundamental problem that has to also be addressed at the legal level.
This is a central question that I'm interested in, because the point is that any kind of legal right is still an anthropocentric right. So I think that we are still focusing on a value that is compared to humans and also compared to a certain kind of human. So women have struggled and have had to enact masculinity in order to get equal rights, and it doesn't account for alterity, and it also doesn't account for the non-consensual nature of the animal labour, that there is no contract, that this social contract is humans talking to humans. And I don't think that any kind of liberty through anthropocentric systems is liberty at all. I think it's just assimilation and recontrolling. And I think that for me, it's very difficult because we do need a palliative. We need activism. We definitely need activism. And I think one of the interesting ways that we can do activism, weirdly enough, is by not acting through things like boycott And as we know, boycott often really hurts big business companies. The rise in veganism, the rise in antinatalism, and the rise in people boycotting certain companies that have dubious practices, it is a form of active non-acting or non-consuming in order to force companies to question their definition of labour and their definition of consent and the imposition of non-consensual contracts on vulnerable people and vulnerable animals.
Patricia and Susan, both of you have been speaking about this question of materiality and also property. And I think both of them are, in a way, things that in the Eurocentric concept of being are almost either refused or centralized. And I've been really thinking about how can we also move away from the Eurocentric understanding of the world making that is centralized now, in the present and for a very long time. And at the same time, for me, a lot of things are, I feel I often speak in that we live in the afterlives of slavery and colonialism. And I also include in when I think about these type, the bodies that have to continuously be these sites for systems, whether it is the capitalist or the patriarchal capitalist system or the racialized system, and how they maneuver also means to kind of rethink what we understand the role of technology is. And for me, the speculative is really thinking in these vacuums or in these spaces in between, and also not thinking of resistance, but thinking about refusal and thinking about sidestepping and what place can a cyborg take or what kind of space can it take in also as a potential body that refuses, a potential body that sidesteps.
In your distinction between resistance and refusal, would you feel connected or somehow in synchrony with what Patricia was saying about boycott, maybe?
Yeah, very much so, because I think we really need to move away from the reactionary, because the reactionary often leads to assimilation, and the capitalist system is built in such a way that everything must be digested to become part of the system. So in a way, it's this ever-growing machine that will be inclusive. So I've also been thinking about inclusivity as a word that maybe one has to get rid of, because it is not useful, because it still means that one wants to be part of something. And that thing remains as toxic as it was before. So I do admire people that are interested in changing particular systems. But I'm almost more and more thinking about how do we get rid of them.
Susana, I wanted to ask you, the automation generally has this promise of freedom because the work is done by others. I guess that in this context that we are discussing, freedom is a very contested notion that we cannot take it for granted. So I wanted to ask you, is technology actually giving more freedom or liberty? And who benefits more from that? Those technologies that have the promise of giving us freedom?
It's a very complicated question because, of course, I think we know well that every technology will redistribute its effects very unevenly. So certainly for some individuals, some bodies, clearly there are all kinds of positive things that come out of kind of technological developments. If we think about disability, for example. I mean, something that is actually a strange kind of paradox in perhaps is if we think about the ways in which all matter, so life forms, non-organic matter, the ways in which everything is being translated into, metricized and translated into a kind of data body, we actually have the metricization of all kinds of practices, bodies, etc., transformed into some sort of kind of data set and then kind of aggregated. A simple example would be the rise of the smart farm. So sensors in the soil, they detect levels of kind of precipitation, alkalinity, et cetera, cows that might be grazing. We're very familiar with the idea of the smart city. But in agriculture, for example, the smart farm exists as another kind of infrastructural paradigm organized around transcoding everything into a data set that then can be kind of managed and controlled. So when I said paradoxical, I meant in some way at the level of data, there's a kind of equivalence or erasure of situated sort of practices, knowledges, different kinds of bodies. Everything is subsumed into a kind of mathematical representation, mathematical abstraction, in fact.
I think that this datification, or it's the abstraction of the world, is actually deeply anthropocentric, and in a way it's deeply modern anthropocentrism, because it all comes down to data as currency. So everything is measured because it's digitalized, it's virtualized, but its value is what makes it a bit or a piece. So everything is measured in this sort of mathematical abstracted way. And so this is why, you know, there is no differentiation between the soil, between a human, between a non-human animal, but all of them are deconstructed into value. And something's value is not based on anything to do with that entity. It's based on its market value. So I think that the modern version of this anthropocentrism is the abstracting nature of capitalism and value.
What would you say about care in this context, like the ethics of care?
I think that care is a wonderful, optimistic version of an activism. I think that care involves a reintroduction of this materiality and specificity, and especially about ethics, the idea that ethics is the thing that occurs between two entities, not because of what they are, but that they are. And so any manifestation of care is an openness to acknowledge that you have an effect on another, and that that effect is something for which you are responsible. So it's almost, I don't want to create a false binary, but it's almost the opposite of this abstraction, because it involves an intimate one-on-one, where the one is, you know, with a concept or a group of people, or the care of not murdering, of not consuming. And so for me, this means that every encounter, even if it's not an actual encounter, is an encounter with an ethical relation. And that's why I think certain activisms such as boycott do constitute care, because the ways in which we care for the earth, we don't yet have a language for. We have to be creative, and there's something very vulnerable about care, but it's a responsibility nonetheless. It's not easy. It's not mapped out for us. I think that caring for the other without demanding the other validate their selfhood is a really important form of care. I think that the concept of creativity is really important, because in our society, creativity is being subsumed by profit and by validity based on worth. And I think we need to stop thinking about both monetary validity and also measuring something's validity as even measurable, because true ethics is having a sort of faith and a hope, a very, you know, non-religious faith and hope, but a faith and a hope that action can produce joy in the other without measuring it, without payback, without a sort of desire for this equilibrium that capitalism insinuates, where everything is trading something for something else.
I would like to actually add empathy, because I think empathy also demands that one does not need to understand the other, but must be able to reconcile in the unknown. That in order to show empathy, one does not need to know or understand what the other entity is, because it is present. And I think, to me, that in combination with ethics and care, and perhaps also the illogical, because in a way, those are, I think, concepts that allow also for a different form of speculation to be present, the different form of conceptualizing a world and a world making that is not necessarily rooted in what we understand as world making currently. I always strive for like pushing in radical empathy, because in a way I think it comes with care. And these, they might be concepts that actually are able to revitalize how people and non-human beings could be able to be in relation with each other.
Susan?
I guess I could offer another example from a conversation we're having at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. And caregivers, so individuals that are looking after, say, elderly parents that might be ill or members of their family that require, you know, a certain degree of care, that's a very intensive labor practice that's completely unpaid. In Britain, care is understood as kind of absolutely essential, and empathy, but with the deregulation of the National Health Service and the cut to funding, etc., the ways in which even caring for has to be assumed as a kind of individual, unpaid responsibility. And the state's response to this kind of predicament was to set up another call center whereby that caregiver would have some sort of minimal kind of support system.
The same in the Netherlands. We have this participatory society concept now that is introduced to reduce costs. But these are choices made to maximize certain profits and to return it partially to the familial or the in the atmosphere of the domestic. Mm-hmm. People in relation have to care now for each other without pay. And I'm not surprised, and then a different reactionary system is put in place that puts people with really low paying wages to deal with the emotional and the violent aftermath of that. And I think that, to me, is not necessarily the radical empathy I'm speaking personally about. I think it is, to me, then it's really almost like a capitalist concept also of empathy, because it is monetized again. It is put in a particular structure in order to reduce potential aftermath of what it would mean to maybe deal with the mental health of people, like the increasing healthcare needs of people that are caretakers. And that is this intertwined system that is somehow is the one that I was speaking earlier about, that is digesting all possible ways that people and non-human beings are together in this world currently. So I just wanted to say that.
Do you have any example that you know that will be countering this other example, for instance, in the UK or the Netherlands, like other systems of care?
I do think about, like, for example, about the Somali remittance concept, where in collective caring for each other, it literally means that you, not necessarily only as a family, but as a group of people that are either related by being together or related by blood, take care of people, whether it is financially or whether it is a physical need that people have. And that type of redistribution, partially of wealth, but also redistribution of needs and redistribution of the weight of care, functions to me over there to a degree much better. But it's also It is a non-recognized, if I think about Somaliland, it's a non-recognized state. So in a way, it's a semi-anarchist state that functions outside of the concept of nationhood. So in a way, people are there also reconceptualizing for themselves what it means to be a citizen, what it means to be a being that belongs or does not belong to a site. So I'm thinking about this out loud, but it's not necessarily a one model that fits all.
Patricia, do you want to add something to this?
My most controversial contribution to this field is my very adamant human extinction antinatalist stance, because I think that our global presence is irredeemable. I also think that it's ridiculous to mourn the absence of the human without acknowledging that to do so overvalues human exceptionalism. And I think also antinatalism gets rid of things like relation and kinship based on likeness and reproduction, because for me, true activism is about creativity and not reproducing the same paradigms that we are enslaved by, really, or that also makes ethics so difficult. And that would involve, obviously, care of the earth. So I'm not proposing that we just all disappear, but that it would demand that we care for what we've done.
Well, I think we can come to an end. I hope not the end of the world yet. I would like to thank you, Patricia McCormack, Amal Al-Haq, and Susan Shupley for joining me today. And I'd like to end with one final question for you all. So what can you see for the future of work? Again, we want to come back to that notion in this post-human space or landscape that we have been defining in the conversation.
What I'd like to see is the end of work, because I'd like to see the end of humans.
Amal?
I was going to say something similar. But
go ahead. Then we agree.
No, I was just thinking about the ability to be in living in a liberated form. I think that is what I would like to see, perhaps sidestepping the work aspect.
Susan?
I would like to see a world in which a diverse set of practices, some of them we could call work, maybe some of them we would call kind of creativity, etc., could be valued differently or not translated into some sort of financial kind of paradigm, if you will. So, yeah, expanding the category of what constitutes work and valuing it in a much more kind of consequential way.
Thank you, you all.
So this discussion felt to me really intense and really, it pushed a lot of boundaries in a lot of different directions.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really fascinated by that. Also by the differences between each one of the speakers. I suppose one of the things that I enjoyed the most about this roundtable was how far it ventured into very radical and very interesting boundary-pushing kind of positions.
Mm.
And this idea of considering all of invisible labor, all forms of violence and exploitations across kind of de-anthropomorphic or anti-anthropocentric boundaries, and to think about all species, all beings in relation to these questions just really stimulated my imagination, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to think of, you know, like within economics, we're only thinking about humans. And for a long time, like, you know, like feminine and domestic labor was not like factored into that equation. And what do we, you know, how do we consider a whole network of relationships to do with just like living on existing on this planet and our relationships with everything non-human into that equation? I mean, it seems like then is when we really get a complete picture.
I guess that's why the question of care as a form of activism that Patricia brought up, or radical empathy that Amal talked about, are such interesting ways of redefining ways of relating to environmental questions and political questions.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of like last series, there was a talk by Timothy Morton, and one of the main kind of points was that nature as a construct is not useful because it creates a separation between us and them.
Right.
When really we are kind of like a whole with, you know, every single relationship that exists on this earth, human and non-human.
Yes.
For the wages were low and the hours were long, and the labor was all I could bear. Now you've got new machines for to take my place, and you tell me it's not mine to share. Down your factories and laid down your fields with my feet on the ground and my back to your wheels. And now the smoke is rising, the steel is all aglow. I'm walking down a jobless road, and where am I to go? And now the smoke is rising, the steel is all aglow. I'm walking down a jobless road, and where am I to go? And where am I to go? And where am I to go?
That was Automation Song from the album Songs for Hardworking People, commissioned by Noam Toran and composed by Rem Coda Jong and Florentine Bodendijk as the soundtrack for the Dutch Pavilion 2018. We spoke to Noam about his inspirations for this album.
The album is basically a cover album, but a very loosely rendered cover album, which takes 12 original songs and kind of recomposites them as if they are work songs for a highly automated working system. And so there is a lot of inhuman elements within it. So I worked with two, I think, remarkable composers, Florentijn Bodendijk and Remco de Jong, and we discussed what work songs in a kind of inhuman working environment might sound like. We increasingly were producing the music through a technological filter, and then all of the music was produced with modular synthesizers to create what I think is a kind of music that at times is, let's say, coherent to human ears, kind of speaks of music, has a beat, sometimes you could dance to, and then dips out of it into something that is incoherent or potentially ugly or difficult to listen to because it's maybe transcended the human spectrum and is now moving into, let's say, computer listening or these types of this sort of expanded spectrum that we're developing through artificial intelligence. So I'm going to just read from one of the works, which is called The Jute Mill Song. It was written by Mary Brooksbank, who worked in the cotton mills. It's credited to have been written around the 1920s. And she writes, "Oh dear me, the world is ill divided. Them that works the hardest are the least provided. Oh dear me, the mill is running fast, and we poor shifters," those are the workers who are running the cotton, the weaving machines, "and we poor shifters cannot get, nay rest, shifting bobbins, coarse and fine, they," being the bosses, "fairly make you work for your 10 and 9, which is an amount, basically, a wage. So I think, you know, already you see the understanding that the workers are caught up in agendas that are not connected to their greater benefit, that their livelihood is actually threatened by the machinery. The pace is not human, the wage is not human, and the world is ill-divided, which is one of the most beautiful lyrics I think I've come across.
Divided. Them that works the hardest are the least provided. Oh, dear me, the world is ill divided. The world is ill divided. Oh, dear me. Dear me, the world. Oh, dear me.
what struck me there is the way that so many terms that came up during the roundtable discussion came up also in Noam's description of the process of making the work, like words like human, post-human, and inhuman.
Yeah, it's interesting we're talking about incorporating non-humans into kind of models of economics, but this is like very much thinking about still like humans at the center, mm-hmm. but like there's a discussion of like, we're not talking about non-humans when we say like the pace and the wage is inhuman. We're talking about like treating a human like they're not a human. That's when previously right. we've been talking about treating non-humans like they are humans.
Right, right. I mean, it's one of the things that I find quite tricky about talking about automation without specifying which and when and who's designing what systems and what kinds of jobs are we looking at when we look at the ones that disappear and so on. Because to a certain extent, I mean, if you're decolonial, post-colonial critical thinker or a feminist, you know that there have always been robots.
People who are unpaid and forced or expected to do the work. Right. I mean, we're talking about domestic labor here, but if we're talking about work songs, then of course we have to talk about slavery.
That's right. Exactly.
This relates to something that Noam was saying, you know, in speaking about considering non-humans in, you know, a model of models of work and labor, thinking about how we would consider or like conceptualize paying like mushrooms and trees for their work. He said, you know, this is ridiculous because humans don't have rights, let alone animals and plants and mushrooms.
Right.
So is there a conflict here? Like thinking back to the discussion, should we even be thinking about wages for animals or robots when most of the human population don't have sufficient workers' rights?
Well, I think the way that Noam puts it, he makes a fairly irrefutable point. But I guess one of the things that I found so interesting about the roundtable is that the proposition that we started with when we started to research for this, which was, well, shouldn't we think about wages for mushrooms then, had within it the flaw that what we were thinking about in terms of work was the only activist or ethical way to think about work is to think about wages or to think about work in the context of an exchange of like service for value or capital. And I think one of the takeaways that I have from the discussion is that itself reinserts any form of invisible or non-invisible work into a kind of regime of exploitation in the first place.
I mean, I was just thinking like within ecosystems, labor that plants do or that mushrooms do like is paid, but it's paid in that like they take from the ecosystem and they give back to the ecosystem.
Right.
And like what we're thinking about is how to kind of like make this thing of give and take like equal among humans, or at least fair.
Well, I guess asking ourselves a sort of speculative question like should mushrooms have wages is a way of asking questions around the rights of quote-unquote nature or the rights of species that we don't acknowledge within other frameworks like the law, like Susan was saying, or the economic system and so on and so forth.
I mean, yeah, we can talk about like giving animals wages, but you know, the Conservative Party just decided that animals are not sentient beings. So like first, it's a lot about just respect and acknowledgement.
Yes,
and
that's right.
I mean, it's not a wage, but like there's something unsettling about like having to transplant like capitalist models of value onto non-humans in order to value them.
That also brings a relatively grim vision, because it's almost like saying you cannot think outside of the current economic system. And let's remind ourselves that it's not the only system that's ever existed, which isn't to say that we know what comes next. But the fact that it's a system that has created a sense that you can't think outside of it.
Yeah, definitely.
Is a very clear sign of its ideological.
Yeah. And being within it shapes your brain, shapes the way that you think, and it makes it even more difficult to leave.
Right.
The Serpentine Podcast. On Work.
The Serpentine Podcast on Work is curated by Lucia Pietroisti and Kay Watson. The guest curator for this episode was Marina Otero. We were produced by Jesse Lawson and Jack Howson from Reduced Listening, with sound design by Dane Law, with additional material from Feminist Economics Yoga by Cassie Thornton. I've been Victoria Sin. Next episode, we'll be partnering with the Design Museum to look at work and the domestic environment. We'll leave you today with another song from Songs for Hardworking People by Noam Toran. This is John Henry.
John Henry said to his captain, "You are nothing but a common man. Before that steam drill shall beat me down, I'll die with my hammer in my hand." John Henry said to the captain, "You must listen to my call. Before that steam drill shall beat me down, I'll jar these mountains till they fall." John Henry's captain said to him, "I believe these mountains are caving in." John Henry said to his captain, "Oh, Lord, that's my hammer, you hear in the wind." John Henry was hammering on the right side, the big steam drill on the left, before that steam drill could beat him down. He hammered his fool self to death.